Steve Lamb, alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
I'm just wondering if there wasn't something a little extra in the coffee on the side over on the left there. You guys are pretty excited. That's good. Okay, so we've talked a lot about a lot of different things this weekend. You know, we spent a lot of time on amends and acceptance and forgiveness and all these things that we've got to do. And now, in this last hour or so, Darren and I are going to try to convince you that despite all appearances, all is well. All is well. Yeah, I know, you're skeptical, right? You're like, hey, no, man. It doesn't feel like all is well. Well, hopefully you've been able to come into the retreat. You'll be able to come in, sit all the way down and participate and listen to all the great stuff that's happened, particularly the meditations. You know, if you're new, welcome to the club that nobody ever wanted to join. The price of admission is very high. You've paid it. There's no membership committee. And you're in the club. You're in the club. Welcome to the place where we share our stories, because we are a society of storytellers. And through that, it really saves our lives. What I want to do to start out with is I actually want to start out with a brief meditation to try to get us focused. And this is something that I'm going to read to you, and then we're only going to have really 2 minutes of silence, so it's not going to take that long. But if you've got a concept of God or a higher power, that's fine. If you've got a problem with it, what I'd like you to do is really listen to and digest the words of what I'm going to read to you. And what I'm read to you is called Thunder. It's from the Nag Hammadi Codex. It's Codex 6. And this is a series of writings that were discovered in 1945 in the upper Nile region in Egypt. And they were buried by some monks well over a century ago, sometime after the passing of Jesus. But for well over 1,800 years, they were not discovered. And it goes like this. So just listen to this and try to digest this. And if you've got some concerns or questions about what a higher power is to you, consider this in this context. This is called Thunder. It's from the Nag Hammadi Codex 6. I was sent out from the power and have come to you who study me, and am found by you who seek me. Look at me, you who study me, and you who hear, hear me. You, waiting for me, take me into yourselves. Don't banish me from your vision. Don't let hatred enter your voice against me, or let anger enter your hearing. In no place, in no time, be unknowing of me. Be alert. Don't be ignorant of me. I am the first and the last. I am silence incomprehensible and an idea remembered often. I am the voice whose sound is manifold and word whose appearance is multiple. I am the utterance of my name. I am one before whom you are ashamed, and to me you are shameless. I am one who is honored, praised, and scornfully despised. I am peace, and war has come because of me. I am alien and citizen. I am the substance and one without substance. Those unconnected to me are unfamiliar with me, and those in my substance know me. I am within. I am unspeaking mute and enormous in my many words. What you see outside you, see within you. Many pleasures exist in many sins, uncontrolled passions and disgraceful desires, and brief pleasures embraced by people until they sober up and float up to their place of rest. There they will find me and live, and they will not die again. Thank you, gentlemen. And the next quote that I'm going to read to you, I want you to consider, when do you think this was written? Okay, listen to this and ask yourself when you think this was written. And who wrote it? As never before, the struggle for power, importance, and wealth is tearing civilization apart. Man against man, family against family, group against group, nation against nation. Nearly all those engaged in this fierce competition declare that their aim is peace and justice for themselves, their neighbors, and their nations. Give us power, they say, and we shall have justice. Give us fame, and we shall set a great example. Give us money, and we should be comfortable and happy. People throughout the world deeply believe such things and act accordingly. Society seems to be staggering down a dead-end road. That stop sign is clearly marked. It says, disaster. Bill Wilson wrote that in 1957. It's in AA Comes of Age. It's Appendix B, Why Alcoholics Anonymous is Anonymous. Sounds like it could have been written yesterday. But he also wrote in Bill's story on page 16, most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We shall have it with us right here and now. And he also said on page 25, we have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence of which we had not yet even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. So is that true? Does that match your experience? Is that your reality? Are both of those true? Can both of those things be true at the same time, right here, right now? In Alcoholics Anonymous, we come in and we realize that we've been suffering from delusions. I still suffer from a few. Hopefully less than when I first came in here, but I still suffer from a few. I've been asleep, and I don't want to wake up. My ego clings to the spirituality that I found in a bottle, which is false, which isn't a real God, which is a false deity, but it worked for so long until she turned on me. And now I can't turn to her anymore, and I got to find something else. And I find it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my ego doesn't want me to contact a God of my understanding. One of my favorite stories is by a guy named Anthony DeMello, and it goes like this. It's about a person named Jaime and his father. And Jaime's sleeping in. He's sleeping in. He's been sleeping in, and his father's knocking on the door. He's like, Jaime, you got to wake up. And Jaime's like, oh, Papa, I don't want to get up. Jaime, you got to get up. It's time to go to school. And Jaime says, oh, Papa, I don't want to go to school. And his father says, well, why not, Jaime? And Jaime says, oh, Papa, school is, it's dull. And the kids tease me. And I hate school, Papa. And his father says, well, Jaime, I'm going to give you three reasons why you need to go to school. One, it's your duty. Two, you're 45 years old. And three, Jaime, you're the headmaster. Now get your ass out of bed and go to school. Now I believe our sponsors at some point in time have said something like that to us. Okay. Anthony DeMello also says that spirituality means waking up, and all mystics are unanimous in one thing, that all is well. All is well, and most people never get to see that all is well because they are asleep. We talk about having a spiritual awakening. But do we stay awake, gentlemen? Do we stay awake, and how do we stay awake? The words mystery and mystic, they share the same root, the Greek mystikos. And a mystery is unexplainable. It's you can't describe it. You have to experience it. And that's what we talk about. And if you're new, welcome to a brotherhood of mystics, because that's what members of Alcoholics Anonymous are. We're exploring the mystery. I remember when Bill talked the other day about this, the third step prayer. Right afterwards, it says the wording was quite optional. as long as we express the idea without reservation. So we have some of our guys write their own third step prayer. One of my guys wrote his third step prayer. He referred to God as Mr. Mystery. And my initial thought was, well, that's rather juvenile. Mm. And then I thought about it, and I thought, it's perfect. It's perfect. Because who can really fully describe that which was indescribable? It can only be experienced. And what do we focus on here? We focus on the experience. The steps are a set of spiritual exercises. They're designed to allow each individual to find, develop, and maintain a conscious contact with a God of his or her understanding based on his or her experience through the steps, so that we could live and move and have our being in the world without drinking alcohol or doing any of the party substances that guys like Josie got in trouble with in Miami. I'm not judging. I'm just saying, right? William James is the only author that's cited in the big book. He wrote a book called The Varieties of Religious Experience. And what he said is, while the revelations of the mystic hold true, they hold true only for the mystic, only for the person that experiences them. For others, they are certainly ideas to be considered, but can hold no claim to truth without personal experience of such. In his book, Varieties, he once said, the sway of alcohol over mankind is unquestionably due to its power to stimulate the mystical faculties of human nature, usually crushed to earth by the cold facts and dry criticisms of the sober hour. Sobriety diminishes and says no. Drunkenness expands, unites, and says yes. And that's why we searched for it for so long. That's why Carl Jung in his letter in 1961 said that the solution is spiritus contra spiritum, which simply means you can have spirituality without alcohol, or you can have alcohol without spirituality, but you're not going to have both. You got to have one or the other. And if you're an alcoholic, you're a seeker, whether you realize it or not. And when you take that substance away that gave you the illusion, the delusion of spirituality, you're going to have to find something else. And if you can't find that something else, you'll go back to the original source that you found. And that's just the nature of it. So all is well. We read it, but do we agree with it? Are we able to demonstrate it? You know, there's a semi-famous Zen proverb. It goes kind of like this. There's this Chinese farmer, and he's got a son. And his son is a bit rambunctious, and his son goes out in the field on a horse, and he falls off the horse, and he breaks his leg. And so the farmer goes into town, and all the farmer's buddies say, oh, that's bad news. That's awful that your son broke his leg. And the farmer says, yeah, good news, bad news. Who knows? Who can say? The next day, the army comes in, and they're conscripting all the young men to go off to battle. And this is like a big deal in this village. Everybody's excited about it because they really want to support China. This is a big deal. The emperor has called to arms, and now they're going to do this. So they have this big celebration, this feast for all these young men that are going to go into the army. And the farmer's in town, and his farmer buddies go, this is bad news. Your son's not going to be able to participate. And the farmer says, good news, bad news. Who knows? And so they have the big festival. They have the party. Everybody gets congratulated. And in the morning, the young men all march off to war. And the farmer stays home with his son, who has a broken leg. And as the newly conscripted army is crossing the river, a flash flood comes down and wipes them all out and kills them. Good news, bad news, who knows? All is well. You know, is my perception real? I talked about getting shot. I mean, when I got shot, that seemed like bad news. That was bad news, right? I get shot. What I didn't talk about was I got to go to the hospital. I go see the doctor. I see the cardiologist. But they also, when you go to the doctor, they do this thing to you. They make you get on this thing called a scale, which measures your weight. Yeah. Yeah. I was 335. Hey, I was a good-looking 335. But I was 335 pounds, right? And you know, the doctor's like, you're overweight. I said, yeah, I'm a little fat. He goes, no, you're obese. Okay. He said, you're approaching maximum density. I think that's the phrase that he used, right? And he said, like, he put me on blood pressure medication. I was borderline diabetic. He told me, he said, you know that tingling in your feet that you're feeling? Yeah. He goes, you may not feel that after a while after you have to lop off a couple toes or maybe your foot if you get diabetes. You know, so I'm on diabetes medication. I'm on all this type of stuff, right? And now I have to follow directions from the doctor. And I do, mostly. Not entirely, to be honest, but I follow most of the instructions. And now I weigh 220. I'm not on the diabetes medication. I'm not on the blood pressure medication. I'm not on a bunch of these medications. I still have to take one little heart medication. But I could have lost a foot. I could have lost a leg. So I get shot. Good news, bad news. Who knows? Now, I have not gone to the guy that shot me and said, thank you for saving my life. I'm not that spiritual, okay? But it's interesting, you know? And a few months after I got shot, I went out to talk somewhere. I'm at a conference. And I gave a talk. And like they do, whether they like your talk or not, they line up to thank you, right? And there's hundreds of people lined up, and they're going through. And finally, there's this elderly lady, and she kind of comes up to me, and she approaches me. And, you know, mostly they shake your hand, and they say thank you. They maybe say a couple things, tell a little story, and they leave. Not her. She grabs my hand and holds it in both hands and pulls it in real close. And she says, I know why God saved you that day. And I'm thinking, okay, here we go. Here we go. I'm ready. Just listen. Pay attention. She goes, God saved you because obviously he had plans for you and there was more work for you to do with us down here. And I thought, oh, that's sweet. I don't know if my sponsor or sponsees would agree with that, but that's sweet. That's nice. We go through another 50-100 people, there's an old guy. He's got a World War II cap on. He's clearly a veteran. He's got a cane. He's hobbling up to me, right? He gets up to me and he shakes my hand. And like the older lady, he grabs my hand. He holds it close. And he pulls me in real close. And he says, I know why God saved you that day. And I thought, okay, here we go, man. Just be cool. You know, just say thank you, right? And he looks at me and he smiles. He goes, only the good die young. Good news, bad news. It's a matter of perspective. And one of the things that a lot of times your sponsor will tell you, particularly when they don't know what's going on, is, well, let's see what happens tomorrow. You know, because we don't know. And sometimes what appears to be bad is not bad. It just really isn't. Or not as bad as we think it is. And sometimes the best action that we can take is to wait and to take no action. We're not good at not doing anything. We want to react. We want to deal with stuff. Darren.
Thanks, Steve. I'm Darren. I'm an alcoholic. There's so much to talk about. Thinking about all is well and, good news, bad news. I recall a time when I was basking in the sunlight of my own magnificence and on a 6-week tour of North America. My wife let me come early so I could do 2 weeks by myself. I went to a conference in Vegas. I flew over and did Akron Founders Day. I flew back to Minnesota and spent some time with Bob, and then flew into New York, and the kids and Jody arrived. They arrived in first class from LA. My daughter, funnily enough, she said, she was 6, I'm never, ever turning right again. And she gets on the plane, left is first class. So that was interesting. We're up in Niagara Falls, you know, having this sort of, celebration. Darren had been working in this corporation for 10 years. They'd gifted him long service leave, and I remember the moment that it happened. We were walking into a ribs. I like some barbecue pork ribs, and we're about to walk into this ribs joint, and the phone rings, and it's my boss. He knows where I am. I'm on holiday. Why is he ringing me? And I answer the phone. He's the executive general manager of sales and marketing for this corporation, reports to the CEO, and he says, I'm out. I'm done. Just want to let you know. Now, this is the guy that I'd attached my little red wagon to, right? This was like, oh my God. Because I knew that the people that were waiting in the wings didn't like him, didn't like me, didn't like all of us that were attached to him, and it wasn't going to be good. And as I explained, I think on Friday night, I ended up leaving that corporation pretty quickly thereafter, and Bob and I were chatting this morning. And I said, you know, it was a good gig. The people weren't very nice though. And it seems 2 or 3 years later, or 4 years later, that I'm working for a really good group of people. Most of the execs are women, and that's a good thing. They're kind, loving, compassionate. They're rated in the top 5 best employers in the country every single year. Good thing, bad thing. It seems like I was meant to be where I'm at. I want to talk. We haven't spoken about gratitude much. I feel like I want to talk about gratitude just for a few minutes. When I changed sponsors at 3 years sober and went through the book, one of the 7 daily newcomer tasks he set for me was to write a gratitude list of 10 things I'm grateful for every day. So I want you to do that as part of your morning meditation. You're not going to enjoy it. Just do it anyway. If you want to cheat, you've got 8 fingers and 2 thumbs. There's 10. Bang. Off you go. And it kind of started like that. You know, I'm grateful that there's fresh water. Blah, blah, blah. And over the years, it's developed. All my guys write gratitude lists frequently, infrequently. You know, that's between them and their God. But I started a Google Groups, and there's about 70 guys on there that send their gratitude lists every day. And mine starts exactly the same way every day. It says, "Good morning, spiritual seeking Jedi peace warriors. This is what I'm grateful for today," and I write 10 things. And in my mind, if I've written that thing in the last week, I'm not allowed to write it again. I have to think hard about it. And now some of the things that I write might be simple, but it reminds me that I'm not running the show. My ego is not in charge. It actually creates a depth of humility, and I know it's, you know, dangerous to say one is humble from the floor of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it actually drives to humility. That I'm actually thankful, thankful for the gifts that I've been gifted. And Wilson wrote in The Grapevine in 1962, "One experience that I practice is to try for a full inventory of my blessings, and then for a right acceptance of the many gifts that are mine, both temporal and spiritual. Here I try to achieve a state of joyful gratitude. When such a brand of gratitude is repeatedly affirmed and pondered, it can finally displace the natural tendency to congratulate myself on whatever progress I may have been enabled to make in some areas of living. I try to hold fast to the truth that a full and thankful heart cannot entertain any great conceits. When brimming with gratitude, one's heartbeat must surely result in outgoing love, the finest emotion that we can ever know." And I've finished my morning meditation before Jody wakes up, before the kids get up in the morning, most days. And I go and make myself a second cup of coffee at this point, because the phone calls are about to arrive, all the sponsees are about to ring. I set aside the next couple of hours for that. But before I do, I make Jody a cup of coffee and I stick it by her nightstand so that when she does wake up, it's there for her. Partially out of living amends, but because I'm grateful for this beautiful woman in my life. My kids get up and I hug them like there's no tomorrow because I'm just so filled with joy, so filled with love that God has gifted them into my life. They're not my kids, they're God's kids that he's asking me to look after for him. They bring me so much more than I can ever bring them. There's a spiritual alchemy that takes place in Alcoholics Anonymous. If I get right in the middle, if you think about, you know, the alchemist converts lead into gold, there's an alchemy that takes place here. If I can just follow the lead of the old timers, take the directions from my sponsor, get right in the middle and just start doing. And that's where it started for me, the doing part. It didn't seem like I was human in any way, shape or form when I arrived. It's a big jump to become a human being. I had to start out being a human doing. There's a guy at one of my home groups, he says, I hate that cliche, think, think, think. That's our biggest problem. It should say do, do, do. So do, do Dave, as we like to call him, nailed it, right? And on the journey to become a human being, I had to become a human doing. And I'm grateful for the men who showed me how to do that. But the alchemist has converted me into a human being. And I get to be today. In getting to be, everything's okay. It's not that everything's going to be okay. Bob corrected me about 3 weeks ago on the phone. I said, oh, everything's going to be okay. He goes, no, Darren, everything is okay. I don't have the power for any of this. I've never had the power. Wilson, again, in The Grapevine, if you haven't read Language of the Heart, it's a heavy book, especially the first two sections are all about the development of the traditions and stuff. And if you're like me, in the first 10 years, I picked it up, read through some of that and threw it away. But in part three, there's some real gold to go and mine. And I know lots of you have taken the opportunity to mine that gold that's in that book. And you know, that's where emotional sobriety essay is. But my favourite essay in there is one on step 11. A guy once said to me, "Are you meditating?" I said, "Yes," and I went, "Yes," and he said, "By the intonation of your voice, does that mean that you're not doing any?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, you do get that meditation is part of the 12-step program of recovery from alcoholism." And he directed me to that reading, take step 11 in The Grapevine. And Wilson writes, "Now we can have some tough times and our friends in AA are apt to congratulate us on how well we're doing. On the inside, we know we're not doing so well. What can be the problem?" And he answers the question in the essay. He says, "The chances are better than even, more than 50%, that you'll find our problem in the misuse or misunderstanding of AA's step 11. I read that, I rang the guy back and I went, oh my God. I'm barely even connected to the source of power. No wonder I'm in my head obsessing all the time about all the drama in my life. I can't stop thinking about me. I've got to get with you. I've got to get with my maker, with the alchemist. And what's happened is I've been converted from that loser, self-centered drunk that couldn't do anything for you to save my life to a God servant, to a you servant. That's alchemy. That's conversion. Yeah. Steve.
You know, once you've been around here a while, you're going to tend to gravitate towards a few individuals. It's not that we glorify them or deify them, but they wind up being men that we learn from. And one of my spiritual teachers, who's now passed away, is Sandy Beach. And in relation to this concept that all is well, I think I used to amuse him. I had a court case in Tampa, so I was able to go there several times during the year, and I would be able to go out to breakfast or lunch with Sandy, and we'd be having a meal, and I'd be babbling, and I think at one point in time I was telling him I wasn't getting my way. And he looked at me, he said, Lamb, do you know how to always get your way? And I thought, okay, finally, here we go. We're going to get the juice. We're going to get the secret sauce. He's going to tell me how to get my way. He says, yeah, just don't have a way. That's not what I had in mind. You know, I thought there would be some more practical application to it, that there would be some things I would do. He said, no, just don't have a way. If you don't have a way, you always get your way. And I remember that just puzzled me for a while until I really thought about it. And he was absolutely right. The other thing that he said to me, which just killed me, was I was telling him, I think the problem of the day, the problem du jour, and he said, Lamb, do you ever have a problem that you don't think about? And I thought, you know, I love this guy. He's getting old. You know, he's getting old. He's kind of losing it. A problem is a problem, right? I mean, it doesn't matter whether I'm thinking about it or not. It's a problem, right? And then I thought about it. I thought, damn, if I'm not thinking about it, it's not a problem. So how do you not think about it? You. You. You know, when I was in the hospital after I got shot, I'm a lawyer, so I get my phone. You're not supposed to have a phone in ICU, but I get my phone. I actually got the nurse to give me her charger, you know, because I got to talk to people. I mean, people need me, right? You know, so these guys are calling me. These sponsees are calling me, right? And they're always, they try to be nice. So they always say, how are you doing? They don't care how you're doing, right? You know, so I tell them, I say, well, you know, I've had better weekends. Well, what do you mean? Well, I got shot this weekend. Really? No kidding. Yeah. Are you going to be okay? Well, they're probably going to release me in a couple days. Well, let me tell you what she did yesterday. So all is well because I infuse myself with you and I get into service and I get out of self and I get into God. One of my favorite stories, and many of you have heard it, but I think the new people probably haven't, is about a guy named the Baal Shem Tov. And in Judaism, they don't have a pope, they don't have a synod, they don't have a head of the Jewish religion. But they have certain rabbis that have importance, one of whom was the Baal Shem Tov. And he's been gone for quite some time, but one of the stories of the Baal Shem Tov, which really relates to both all is well and forgiveness, is that as the Baal Shem Tov was dying, he gathered his disciples around him. And he assigned them all tasks. And there was one disciple who was like, I'm ready, you know, I'm waiting. And because what was happening was one guy was getting, okay, you're going to be in charge of rabbinical studies in Jerusalem. The other one is you're going to go to Syria and start, you know, a Jewish school. Finally get to the last guy. And he's very excited because he's thinking, this is going to be cool. I can't wait for the Baal Shem Tov to give me my assignment. And the Baal Shem Tov tells this guy, your job is to wander throughout the country. And when people ask you for stories about the Baal Shem Tov, you tell them stories about the Baal Shem Tov. He's like, really? That's it? But you know, he's a disciple, right? So he's a follower. He's like, okay, thank you, thank you. He walks out going, wow, I got hosed. I got hosed on this one, right? But you know, the Baal Shem Tov dies and he does this. He does this for several years. And then one day there's a nobleman in Italy that beckons for him to come to tell him a story about the Baal Shem Tov. So he gets on the horse, he goes over to Italy, and he gets to this nobleman's estate, and he rides up and gets off the horse, and the nobleman says, okay, rest and clean up and then come tell me a story after dinner. So the guy does what he's told. He comes to tell a story, and the nobleman says, okay, I'm ready for the story. And the disciple's like blank. He's like, this has never happened to me. I've always had stories. I've been with the Baal Shem Tov for decades. I can't think of a single story. The nobleman says, look, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Just go rest up overnight. Maybe you had a long journey. Come back tomorrow. Tell me a story. So he does, and he comes back the next day, and the same thing happens. He just can't think of a single story. But the nobleman is very gracious. He says, okay, we'll do this one more time. Just relax. Rest up. Don't worry about it. Guy comes back the next day, and the disciple's been racking his brains. He just can't think of a story. And finally, when he gets in front of the nobleman, he says, I can only think of this one story, but it's not a very good story. It's the only story that I can remember. And the nobleman says, okay, well, go ahead, tell me the story. And the disciple says, well, a long time ago, we were in Jerusalem. We were leaving Jerusalem, and we got asked to go to Turkey. It was during the time of the Christian Passover, you know, and there was a school and a rabbi that wanted to meet with the Baal Shem Tov in Turkey. And so the Baal Shem Tov said, saddle up the horses, let's go. And the disciple said, you know, I was a little concerned at the time because there was some turmoil going on in Turkey at the time. And in fact, what was going on was there was, in our view, some persecution of a lot of Jews. Not only by the Christians, but by the Muslims. It was kind of a dangerous place to go at that time, but the Baal Shem Tov said, let's go, so we go. So they go off to Turkey. And they get to the little town, and they go in the town, and they go to find the rabbi, and they go into the rabbi's house, and the rabbi is inside the house, and there's several other people in the house, and all the shutters are closed, because what's happening on that day is they're having a procession. Because the local bishop is going to come down the street with like a parade and then is going to give a big speech and then they're going to have mass at the end of the square. And the people in the house don't want to call attention to themselves. So they have all the shutters closed. So the Baal Shem Tov looks around and he walks over to the shutters. He throws open the shutters. They're wide open and everybody's kind of going like, this, you sure, right? And the Baal Shem Tov, you know, starts talking to the rabbi, and they go into the other room, and the disciple's waiting in the room, right, by himself. And then the rabbi comes back in with the Baal Shem Tov, and they're talking off in the corner, and through the open shutters, the disciple sees the procession start to come down. And he sees the bishop, and the bishop has a beautiful mitre cap on, and he's got a staff, and they're going through, and they're singing. And he's very nervous about this. And he notices as they go through, the bishop looks in and sees the Baal Shem Tov. And the Baal Shem Tov looks at the bishop and goes, gives him a little head nod. And then they proceed on. And after the Baal Shem Tov finishes with the rabbi, he calls the disciple over and he says, look, I want you to go find the bishop and tell him I want to talk to him. And they just, are you sure? Yes, yes, go tell the bishop I would like to talk to him. So the disciple follows directions. He goes to the end and they're finishing up mass and he's a little nervous. He doesn't know what to do and he reaches over and he tugs on the, you know, the bishop's gown and says, sir, I need to talk to you. He said, what do you need? He said, the Baal Shem Tov would like to talk to you. Where is he? Well, he's down the street, sir. All right, so he takes the bishop down, and they go into the house, and they go into a back room, And the bishop is back there with the Baal Shem Tov for 3 or 4 hours. And then the bishop leaves and the Baal Shem Tov comes out and says, saddle up the horses, we're going back to Jerusalem. And we went back to Jerusalem. And the disciple looks at the nobleman and goes, man, I'm sorry, that's it. That's the whole story. I don't have anything else. And the nobleman is crying. He's burst into tears. And he says to the disciple, he says, I want to thank you. What you don't understand, what you don't realize is, I was the bishop. I was born and raised in a Jewish family. I was a good Jewish boy. But because of what was going on at the time and for commercial reasons, I really didn't believe in Christianity, but I converted. Basically for financial reasons, and so I wouldn't be persecuted. And I did such a good job at it that they eventually made me the bishop. But I had trained under the Baal Shem Tov like 30, 40 years earlier. And when he walked by, he recognized me and he called me back. And I just broke down in front of him and I said, I felt bad. I felt guilty. I felt awful about what I'd done. How could I make amends? How would I ever be forgiven? And the Baal Shem Tov looked at me and he said, all is always forgiven, my son. And one day you will realize that when a man comes to you and tells you your story. And that's exactly what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. One day we sit there and we hear a man tell us our story. And we know we are forgiven. And we know that all is well. Darren?
Steve. Oh, it's such a great story. My mind is blank. It's been such a great weekend, hasn't it?
You're a disciple.
Yes.
You're Bob's disciple.
I've been converted from think, to do, to just be. I don't have to perform anymore. There's a little poem that I love, which I'd like to read, if that's okay. I am the place where God shines through, for he and I are one, not two. He wants me where and as I am. I need not fret, nor fear, nor plan. If I will be relaxed and free, he'll carry out his work through me. And what a gift it is that I get to be free. It's the big promise here in Alcoholics Anonymous. That I get to be free from the demands of my ego. Freedom from the bondage of self. Me thinking about me. Well, the other thing I love doing is me thinking about what you think about me. I get to be just free. The third step promises, if I stick close to him, my higher power, and perform his work well, all of my needs will be met. And whilst I share with my sponsees while we're going through that part of the book, 62 and 63, I'm happy to share my experience of what that means. I let them have their experience of what that means for them. What does stay close mean? Now, we've talked about it. Clearing the channel, keeping it clear, having a daily meditation practice, staying spiritually close by being. And then get out there, get busy, serving God's kids. Now, I used to think that God's kids were you, all you crazy drunks. I found out that we're all God's kids. The people on the roads are God's kids. The guy at my work who I don't like, he's one of God's kids too. Everybody I come across, I have a clear mission to try and serve, to try and be of service. And I've converted that into the Buddhist instruction of bring loving kindness to every person that I can. And I can't get there without forgiveness. I have to forgive everyone for everything. Otherwise, I can't bring loving kindness to everyone. Because if I haven't forgiven everyone for everything, I haven't started the process of either, whichever camp you're in, forgiving yourself or accepting forgiveness for yourself. While I've still got, you know, the knife against one of you, I'm going to eventually have to turn it against myself. So forgiveness is key to the future. It's key to the release of the bondage of self. It's key to me being able to get the true benefit of what's on offer here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The spiritual awakening, bringing loving kindness to every creature on the planet, there's nothing that I love more these days than going out into my backyard on a sunny spring afternoon and sit on a little camp seat with no shoes on and wriggle my toes in the grass and sort of just tilt my head backwards towards the sky and watch the leaves swaying on the gum tree. Watch the clouds float by and just be. You've gifted me that by coming here, by giving me the tools, by laying out the spiritual tools at my feet, by encouraging me, by loving me, by turning a blind eye sometimes to all of my faults. Whether it's because we're brothers in defects, so you just love on me anyway, he'll eventually work it out. But you've gifted me that greatest gift, the spiritual awakening, the ability to love others. And I think we've already talked about it. I don't know whether it was you, it was Bill, it was Scott last night. While I'm busy splashing love all over you, the byproduct is I feel love in my heart. I talked about a pretty traumatic childhood on Friday night. I never felt love. Never felt loved. And I especially didn't have any feelings of love in my heart before I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the greatest gift that comes from trying to be is that I get to love. And the door that opens up is I get to feel love as a result. How beautiful is that? There was this old timer in Sydney, he was 64 years sober when he died, and everyone loved him. Everyone loved this guy. And I felt like people didn't love me enough. And I started writing on that topic of, why does everyone love Ron? And I found out, I kept writing and writing and writing. Ron never had a bad word to say about anyone. Ron was the guy that ran to the door when the new guy showed up and put his arm around him. Loved on everybody that he came across, loving kindness every moment of his life. I want to be like Ron. I want to be that guy that has the ability to push past my ego and just love on people. I'm not there yet. I'm getting better. So that's my goal. Try and bring loving kindness to as many human beings as I can in this moment right now. I get to be free and I get to feel that love as a result. Steve?
Thanks, Darren. On behalf of Darren and I want to just say it's really been an honor and a privilege to be able to share with you this weekend. And I'm not talking about up here, I'm talking about out there. And if you're new, I'm just hoping that you've come to the realization that I am not, you are not, we are not separate and apart. I am, you are, we are all a part of, not apart from.
Mm.
And that's why we join together for retreats like this. Why don't we close with the Lord's Prayer? Sound good?
Mm.
You want to do it?
Yep, let's do it.
Okay.
Whose Father?
Our Father.
Our Father.
Who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us.
And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks, man. I love you. You're the best friend. That wasn't in my script. You did very well. You did very well. Did you have fun? That's the important thing. Okay.